In this weekend's episode, three segments from this past week's Washington Journal. First, we speak with Ryan Clancy, chief strategist for the group No Labels, about whether and when they'll decide on a third-party unity ticket for the upcoming presidential campaign. Then, Jess Braven, who covers the Supreme Court for the Wall Street Journal, on this week's ruling by the High Court that states cannot kick former President Donald Trump off the ballot for his actions leading up to the January 6th attack on the Capitol. Plus, a conversation with writer and comedian Corinne Fisher, host of the podcast Without a Country.
Hello, I'm Pam, and joining me today is Zach as we celebrate 45 years of C-SPAN's unblinking eye on the democratic process.
That's right, Pam. Since our founding in 1979, C-SPAN has been documenting history with a unique approach, unfiltered, without commentary, and entirely independent from government funding. C-SPAN is funded by fees from our cable and satellite distribution partners, and now, with fewer people subscribing to cable and satellite, we're asking you to help support our next 45 years.
It's amazing to see how C-SPAN has adapted and grown. With the rise of digital platforms and social media, C-SPAN has expanded its reach so that no matter where you are, you have 24/7, 365 access to the democratic process.
As we navigate this ever-changing media environment, C-SPAN's dedication to putting you in the rooms where politics is debated and policy is determined will not waver.
We ask you to support C-SPAN's vital mission. As we celebrate 45 years of service, your contribution helps us to continue to adapt and grow in this digital age. Visit cspan.org/donate to make your contribution today.
So, here's to 45 more years of bringing democracy directly to you wherever you get your news. Thank you for your support. Visit cspan.org/donate today to make a difference.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
We begin with Ryan Clancy, chief strategist for the group No Labels.
Real quick, remind viewers of No Labels, how it got started and why.
No Labels, we've a group that's been around for 14 years. I've spent most of that time working in Congress, trying to bring leaders together on both sides together to solve problems. And we're still very active doing that. But what we've got a lot of attention for the last 2 years, of course, is our effort to get on the ballot for 2024, which we might use to offer to a unity presidential ticket.
And, you know, you've some critics label you as a dark money group. Can you talk about your funding and why you don't disclose your donors?
Sure. Well, in our 14 years, we've never released the names of our individual supporters. And it's all individuals from across the country. We don't take corporate money. But there's a reason for that. In America, when you're affiliated with a nonprofit organization, you've got a right to privacy. And we've always promised our supporters that, especially, and I'm sure we'll get into this in a bit, given the fact that a lot of the people who want to shut down No Labels' effort to get on the ballot have made it explicit that one of the ways they want to do that is to intimidate and bully supporters of No Labels to get them to walk away from our movement. And obviously, we're not going to subject our supporters to that.
Well, for the past several months, No Labels has been laying the groundwork to field an independent unity presidential ticket. Where does that effort stand now?
I mean, look, we're making great progress. The key to all of this is ballot access. We have been working on this for 2 years now. I mean, just for context, at this point, 1992, Ross Perot had only just started his ballot access operation. Because it's very much shoe leather work. It's people with clipboards getting signatures and grocery store parking lots and football tailgates and everything else. But he had barely started it at this point, and he ended up on all 50 states. Well, we're already on the ballot in 16 states. We're active in 17 others. The final 17 states plus DC, if there's a unity ticket, that ticket would be responsible for getting the ballot access. And the only reason we're not doing those is there are some states that actually require you to have a named candidate to get on the ballot. But most everywhere else where we can be active, No Labels is working to secure ballot access.
So, Ryan, your spokesperson has said that you're looking at, quote, sometime after Super Tuesday to determine if we offer our line and who would be on it. It's after Super Tuesday. So
yes.
What's happening?
So the big event for us this week is Friday. We're going to have our 800 delegates. These are just our most dedicated citizen supporters from all 50 states across the country. And they'll be meeting on Friday. It'll be a gathering moderated by former Dallas Mayor Mike Rawlings, who's one of our great volunteer leaders. And they're going to decide where we go from here. You can really think of this as this is a gut check for our movement, because one of the things we've said is we only want to put forth a ticket if we feel like it has a viable path, like we feel like it could really win. We have no interest in fueling some kind of spoiler effort. So on Friday, these 800 folks from across the country will make their voice heard, and they'll let us know where they want to take this.
But really, I mean, in today's environment, how could a third party candidate not be a spoiler?
Well, the thing is, you got to look at past elections, and certainly over the course of the last, you know, decades, independents typically don't get much traction. For you to think that they could get traction, you have to believe that this time actually is different than previous elections. And Mimi, we believe that, and voters believe that. We have never, and you can go down the list of metrics, but we have never been in a situation where both parties are this unpopular, where the presumptive nominees are this unpopular, where people are this pessimistic about the future of the country. I mean, when we started first thinking there was an inkling of an opening up for this was 2 years ago. A consistent poll question we've been asking over time were if it were Trump, Biden, and a moderate independent alternative, would you be open to voting for that independent? And the first time we asked that in a poll of 25,000 voters, 59% of voters said they'd be open to voting for that ticket. Now, why is that so important? Here's why. It's not because we think an independent, if it ran, would ever get 59% of the vote. But it's because in a multi-candidate race, they don't have to get anywhere close to that. Because remember, Electoral College is winner take all. So if you're in a multi-candidate race, you're getting 34-35% of the vote in a state, you get 100% of the votes that come with it, electoral votes.
I guess the next part of fielding a ticket is deciding who would be on it. And, you know, Senator Joe Manchin had been mentioned. He has declined. Former Governor Larry Hogan is going to be running for the Senate. Are you running out of candidates, or is there somebody out there that we don't know about?
No. Yes. The short answer is there is plenty of people out there that folks don't know about. And
like who?
Well, look, the thing is over the last couple months, there's been lots of candidates that have been floated out there as potential No Labels candidates, but they're always floated out there by somebody else. So we're talking to several candidates that we think would be exceptional that could serve on the ticket. And if our community of delegates, those 800, come together this Friday and decide they want to keep this process going forward, then we'll really escalate our discussions with potential candidates and see about putting up a ticket.
And what do you say about the number of people that have voted uncommitted in the Democratic primaries? Does that tell you that there's an appetite for what you're doing, or is it simply just sending a message to President Biden on a particular issue?
I don't know if I would. I don't know if I would characterize that particular phenomenon of uncommitted as a lead indicator for openness to a No Labels ticket. But here's what I would say. You know, we got to remember that these primaries are not representative where most of the electorate is at. I mean, you know, at best, even in a good year, maybe 25% of the electorate votes in the Democratic or Republican presidential primaries. A lot of states don't even allow independents to vote at all. This is how we find ourselves, Mimi, in a situation where for 2 years, the public, 70% of the public is saying they don't want a rematch of the 2020 election. Well, how can it be that if 70% of the country doesn't want it, it looks like we're going to get it? And the answer is our primary system. The answer is both parties in different ways are exhibiting increasingly intense control over the process and trying to shut out voices, not just independent voices like No Labels. They're shutting out voices within their own parties. You look at the Democratic side, you know, they wouldn't even let Dean Phillips on the ballot in several states. You know, for their part, the Republicans National Committee was ready to shut down the whole primary after New Hampshire. The RNC actually had a resolution on the floor to just declare Donald Trump the presumptive nominee. I guess they didn't think the next 48 states needed to talk. So I think that these primaries are becoming increasingly unrepresentative of where voters are. And that's the biggest reason why we think there's an opening.
That was Ryan Clancy, chief strategist for the group No Labels. Next, a closer look into that Supreme Court decision earlier this week that ruled that the 14th Amendment did not allow Colorado to bar the former president from the state's primary ballot. That conversation with Wall Street Journal Supreme Court correspondent Jess Braven.
So what specific legal question did the Supreme Court rule on yesterday?
Well, there were a number of arguments that Donald Trump raised in his appeal, but the Supreme Court really homed in on one of them, which is that only Congress can enforce Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. That's the provision that bars former officials who engaged in insurrection or rebellion from public office. The Supreme Court said that only Congress can set out the rules for enforcing that provision against federal candidates and federal office holders. So that was the specific question. Colorado's Supreme Court, of course, is a state court. It had no authority to make the determination that Donald Trump was ineligible for engaging in insurrection.
Were you surprised that it was a unanimous ruling?
No, I was not, because of the many, many Trump cases that the Supreme Court is hearing. This one seemed pretty clear that the court was going to go in this direction. That was clear at the oral argument. And it also was, I think, the consensus view of many observers of the court, because the implications of allowing each state to make this kind of determination were pretty severe. That means the same candidate, as the Supreme Court majority said, could be qualified in some states, not qualified in others, even based on the same conduct or the same record. So this one was not really a shocker.
So the while the nine justices all agreed with the opinion, the three liberal justices offered a concurring opinion. Can you explain what their argument was?
Sure. And to use the sometimes exotic nomenclature of the Supreme Court, all nine agreed with the judgment, but not the opinion. There are only five who agreed with the majority opinion, which was unsigned, but we know who they were because there were four who didn't, and we know who they are. So process of elimination leads you to who was in the majority. Three liberal justices jointly authored an opinion that initially, according to some indications, was a partial dissent because somebody noted the metadata on the document that the Supreme Court published used the word dissenting in part to refer to that opinion. Now, that's not what it said when it came out, so they decided to frame it more diplomatically as a concurrence. But it's a more indication that this court was pretty divided about how far to go in ruling for Donald Trump. And that's really what the issue was. How far should the Supreme Court go in saying Trump stays on the ballot? And the majority went pretty far in laying out a specific way to enforce Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. The three in that concurring opinion said, look, we agree that only federal law can enforce this when it comes to presidential candidates, but you're closing the door to many other situations where federal law could step in. For example, let's say someone was being prosecuted by an insurrectionist or a prosecutor appointed by an insurrectionist. Could you raise that as a defense in court and say, look, you have no right to bring charges against me because you do not legitimately hold the office? That possibility apparently was foreclosed by the majority opinion, the dissenters said. And also, Justice Amy Coney Barrett who is herself a Trump appointee, his final one, just in the final months of his term, she also said she did not agree that the majority should go so far. The majority should not go so far, she said. But the spotlight should be on the fact that they all agreed on the bottom line. She basically said it was it wasn't the right time to kind of heighten division and point out divisions. Americans should note that they all agreed on the outcome of this specific case and not the disagreement within justices about how to get there.
And does this Supreme Court decision put an end to all other similar efforts to remove former President Trump from the ballot?
Yes, it does. If they're in state court, just last week, an Illinois state judge agreed with the Colorado courts and said Trump can't be on the ballot because he engaged in insurrection. That action comes to an end, and I think so will pretty much every other action at the state level.
And remind viewers what else the Supreme Court is looking at when it comes to the former president and January 6th in particular.
Donald Trump has given the court a lot of work to do this term. The most important case that is coming up is going to be argued in April, and that involves Trump's appeal of lower court decisions that he must stand trial on charges that he attempted to subvert the 2020 election. Trump has argued unsuccessfully so far that because he was president when he took these actions that are allegedly criminal, he enjoys a constitutional immunity from prosecution. To do otherwise would subject anything a president does to potential prosecution or litigation after he leaves office, and would hamstring future presidents who would be too trepidatious about making bold decisions for fear of being prosecuted in the future. That's his argument about why even a former president should not be exposed to potential prosecution. The Supreme Court is going to hear that argument in April and make a decision, we would think, before the end of June. And that will determine whether he goes on trial in Washington, D.C. On those charges brought by special counsel Jack Smith. And then there are a number of other Trump-related cases, including the ones that are a little bit more amusing. There's a trademark dispute over the phrase, Trump too small. A California man who doesn't care for the former president wants to trademark that phrase and sell T-shirts and knickknacks displaying it. The Biden administration is opposing him and says you can't trademark the name of a political candidate against that candidate's wishes. So there you have the Biden administration defending Donald Trump's interest in the use of his own name. So we have a whole range of cases from the amusing to the deadly serious involving Mr. Trump.
That was Wall Street Journal Supreme Court correspondent Jess Braven.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Finally, writer and comedian Corinne Fisher stopped by our C-SPAN studios when she was in town for some comedy shows. She talked to us about her podcast, Without a Country, and her interest in politics.
Why did you pick that title, Without a Country?
That was actually selected by a former co-host, another comedian named Joe DeRosa. I think it's just because we feel so, or so many people feel politically homeless these days. We feel like we're out without a political party, without a country, and that was how that was born.
And so what do you talk about on your podcast?
So basically, it started out as just we go over the biggest news stories of the week from the perspective of the right and the left using mainstream news sources. You know, we try not to do anything too wild, but we just want to find the truth in the middle, and that's what it is, because I think there's a lot more similarities between Democrats and Republicans than we'll let on. People also seem to be unaware of, like, journalistic integrity. Like, there are rules that journalists must abide by. They can't just be telling full-out lies, so we kind of look into that a bit.
And who do you talk to? Is it just you, or what does it sound like for people who haven't heard
these days? Yeah, we've done a couple co-hosts, like we've with Joe DeRosa, for instance. When we started the podcast, he was further right than I was, and then we had a second co-host, and that was Shane Smith, another comedian. He was from Salt Lake City, Utah, is from Salt Lake City, Utah. Grew up in a Mormon area. He himself is Jewish. He actually recently converted to Catholicism, and he was kind of like extreme left, you know, almost anarchist. And so then that made me look more conservative. And then he moved away, and I just continue to do the show alone, which I really like, but I just have to make sure that I'm doing my critical thinking. And now I have on a lot of different types of guests, not every week, but sometimes.
And where do you identify yourself as where you land politically?
I self-identify as a liberal gone rogue. That's what I call myself, except for when I'm on Fox News, and then I just stick to liberal because I don't want them to get any ideas that they're trying to, like, get me, you know? But yeah, that's how I, because I am, my views are leftist, but I do think that the left needs a lot of work to kind of sell themselves better, make themselves more appealing, more likable, less of an elite attitude, you know?
What do you think being a comic brings to your lens on the news?
Well, less intelligence. I mean, yeah, this, make no mistake, this podcast was created to be accessible. Every week I'm finding a word and I go, I don't know what that word means, and let's look it up together. I continuously pronounce people's names wrong, but I think it's real. I think a lot of people have these seemingly highbrow discussions about politics in the office or at the Thanksgiving dinner table. And in reality, they don't really know that much. And I think it's okay. I think there's actually a lot of value in saying, I don't fully understand that concept. I'm gonna look into that more. I think there's a lot of value in that. There's no shame. No one's expected to know everything about anything.
So with so much happening, how do you decide what topics you're going to do?
We try to do we'll do like the heavy hitters, or it usually is a main story. And then I also try to look into things that I don't see people discussing a lot. I'll just go through, you know, I gotta go through, you know, Washington Post, New York Times, Fox News, The Hill. Sometimes I'll even go to like InfoWars. I do Breitbart sometimes, and then we'll do things like Vulture and kind of just see what are people talking about. And usually on NPR or something, there is some, you know, a topic that isn't being discussed, and I'll always offer that as well.
And who would you say the audience is for your podcast? I know you said you want to make it accessible, but
sure.
Who in particular?
It's definitely a lot of young women. Well, I mean, I'm getting older, so maybe they're following me.
We're both young.
Yeah, I would say like 25 to 45 year old women. That's just because I have kind of an OG podcast that is extremely popular. So it was a lot of leak over from that podcast, which is kind of a 25 to 45 year old female demographic. But I'm also on a network called Gas Digital Network that is notoriously male skewed, and I went on there on purpose. It's pretty misogynistic network, but I placed my show on there on purpose to talk to people that I think would really disagree with me. Like, I don't want to just keep talking in an echo chamber. I think that's the mistake that a lot of liberals make.
So what do you get back from that?
People always think it would be a lot of venom, and honestly, it's not a lot of venom. It's a lot of people interested in having even-keeled discussions. I have been so blown away by how calm the emails I've been getting are. Like, even if they vehemently disagree with me, we kind of really worked together over the past 4 years to have civil conversations. I've learned a lot. I think the listeners have really leaned into critical thinking and not just going along with whatever their political party is telling them to go along with, like really seeking the truth, that's all I can ask. I really, like when I say I want you to vote, like I truly mean, if you want to vote for Donald Trump, vote for Donald Trump. Like, I do not mean vote for Joe Biden. Like, I really don't. I just want people to care about the place that we live in.
So let's talk about some of your recent episodes.
Sure.
213, you said that you cover politics for everyday people who don't have time to parse the news.
Okay, yes.
Say more about that.
Did I use the word parse? I doubt I did.
I doubt that.
That doesn't sound like me.
Okay. But say that you're trying to help someone sort through the news.
Yeah.
In particular, when it comes to misinformation, how do you handle things like that?
Like people saying that something is fake news, for instance. I mean, we just go through various news sources, and it's pretty clear. I mean, like, even when you read something, like I said, like from the New York Times, and then compare it to Fox News, it's very rarely different information. What I find when people say fake news is I kind of feel like they mean that certain news sources will hone in on something that is a small detail and blow it out of proportion. Like, I mean, especially like Fox, for instance, just absolutely obsessed with trans people and making it, you know, considering they are like 1% of the population, you would think they are 55% of the population based on how often Fox News is covering trans issues in, you know, usually a pretty transphobic manner.
But what about sort of actual misinformation, especially right. heading into an election? How do you imagine yourself helping your audience navigate some of these things?
Yeah, I mean, we're gonna do it together. Obviously, I wasn't there. I don't know. I know one concern that a lot of people in news were bringing up is kind of like social media false information. You see just an excess of memes that some guy, I don't know, you know what, maybe some girl made it in her basement, okay? Like just a lot of political memes, charts, graphs. People don't really realize how easy it is to make a chart or a graph and just plop it on your Instagram. Like there is no fact checking on social media. And because that's so often where we get at least the start of a news story now, especially you know, on Twitter, you know, X, whatever we're calling it now, stories start a lot there. And Elon Musk is doing a terrible job of fact-checking. Just anything goes there nowadays. So, you know, we're just going to kind of keep following stories until we get more updates.
You're obviously a very funny person. You do it for a living.
Hopefully.
But some of the topics you cover on your podcast are quite serious.
Yeah.
I was listening to your most recent episode, and you were talking about the self-immolation outside of the Israeli embassy.
Yes.
How do you sort of navigate that?
I have a kind of jokes about anything rule. That's when you're tuning into a podcast hosted by a stand-up comedian, like, please take your sensitive blinders off. That being said, obviously, like, I want to talk about things seriously, and I don't always want to deflect with a joke, and it gives me the space to do that. You know, I have 2 hours to basically give a political monologue every week. Our brains, comedians, they just kind of work in a way where, like, if you see, like, that, you see an awful joke in your head surrounding a serious issue, like, I say it almost to get it out of the way, and then we move on with it. You know, we move on. Comedians voice the bad thoughts in your head that you are fighting against constantly. We just say them and we'll take the heat for you. I have no problem doing that.
That was comedian, writer, and podcast host Corinne Fisher. Hear more interviews from C-SPAN's Washington Journal program on our website, cspan.org, on the C-SPAN Now app, or on C-SPAN Television, live every morning from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern.